mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons. It bankrupts schools and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO News Director Jenka Soderberg in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, you're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 11 o'clock and time for the dirt bag. Coming right up, we're going to talk about nuts and blooming plants. Glenn and Jim are in there ready to talk to you. But first, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from One Green World, a local nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food or decorate your yard or deck or patio. To order plants or their 2015 color catalog, their website is onegreenworld.com, or you can reach them by phone at 1-877-353-4028. Also by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Good morning. It's the second Wednesday of the month at 11 o'clock. It's time for the dirt bag. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. And here beside me is Jim Gilbert. Welcome, Jim.
Morning, Glenn.
Jim made the trek in from the
farm.
Well, either. Yes. Do you go upriver?
Downriver.
You're upriver from here. You follow the rivers down.
I went to Canby and then went on the beautiful Highway 99 between Canby and Oregon City, and then through all of the suburbs, Milwaukee, Gladstone, then into southeast Portland. And the traffic wasn't bad. And in my Leaf, I hardly used any electricity to get here. I was so pleased.
You hardly use any electricity?
That's right. I drive this all-electric Leaf, and if I don't use much electricity, I can turn the heater on.
Oh. So, and will you be able to get back?
Absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
I haven't hardly used a fourth of the juice in that battery, so
yeah.
I'm pretty pleased.
All right. Well, boy, leaves, speaking of.
Right.
'Tis the season, and this rain is bringing them down. I think that's one task that I'll be doing this week is gathering up more of those wonderful leaves for mulching and whatnot. Well, we've got a full show, as always. We invite your questions, though, at the top, 503-231-8187, if you have any questions about gardening-related or Jim's Leaf, even.
You're right. I'd love to talk about the Leaf.
We've got a garden stumper at half past the hour that has to do with our first topic, which is growing nuts in the in western Oregon, and right along with that is our plant of the month, almonds. We'll also talk about some blooming plants this time of year. Yeah, what's blooming? And we've got some that'll brighten your eyes and nose. Mm-hmm. And Jim's going to maybe follow up on what we've been talking about a little bit on persimmons, because it's, you know, when to harvest, and you'll be seeing them around town now. The leaves are dropping off the tree and leaving this beautiful orange fruit. So what's up with that? Uh-huh. Should be a new segment. What's up with that, Jim?
What's up with that? Right. So,
but first of all, we have our plant of the month, almonds. And think about gardening questions that you have, 503-231-8187. Oh, by the way, all my musical selections this time, a tribute to the late Alan Toussaint. Or is that Toussaint? I believe it's pronounced both. For us Anglo, we can try. But that's coming up. So, almonds.
Yes. Well, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, think about how many people talk about almonds in the Northwest. We associate that totally with California. And this year, they became kind of newsworthy, maybe not such a great way, because people started realizing how much water mm-hmm. they use to grow almonds in California. And I think I was hearing something like each almond is like 6 gallons of water, which is quite a lot.
That is quite a lot, yeah.
So here we are thinking about almonds, and almonds are kind of unique nut, because they're basically a relative of many fruiting crops like peaches and apricots and cherries and plums. And so basically an almond might be described as a peach pit. It's just an edible one. And when with the almond itself never develops a nice juicy fruit, it just has kind of a dried kind of husk that, you know, could resemble a dried peach, I guess you could
say. Well, let me just interrupt here in saying that what I've learned from being in the beekeeping industry, not that I take my bees to the almond orchards in California, but I do hear about them quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And the husk of the almond is quite nutritious still, and is used, even though it's not a fruit, we just use the nut, but it's used as animal feed.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, okay. We haven't had enough almond husks around here to do that yet, but we're working on it. So
okay.
That's a good idea. So as I said, this almond is related to all these other prunus family plants, and for reasons that I'm not totally certain of, and I'd like to do more research on this, they've really never been grown here, or at least not in any amount. There've never been a commercial crop, as far as I know, in Oregon.
Once again, from the bee industry, at least in California, those crops bloom so early.
Right.
You know, February.
Right.
So that could be one reason.
And that is from what we know of the California varieties, is they do bloom too early here. So as part of some travels that I had made over to the former Soviet Union, we were able to bring back some varieties from Ukraine, that southern Ukraine, that bloom late. Uh-huh. I'm very excited about that. And so we have 5 varieties. And this year, I usually prune them fairly severely because I want to get the more cuttings to make more of them. But this year we left a bunch unpruned and got really pretty neat crops of almonds off of our trees. I've got boxes of almonds now from our own trees.
So when do they bloom?
They bloom about the same time as peaches do. So it's in March.
March, April.
Yeah, late March.
Plenty of time. I mean, still not out of frost danger, but usually.
Right. They'll stand a light frost, of course. Mm-hmm. It's when they're blooming in February, they're just the factors are just not there for them. I think rain also is heavier. You know, we just have colder, wetter weather, and pollinators aren't flying. And so, they do need bees like they do in California. But I'm pretty bullish on almonds now after our experiences with them.
Well, after we take this call, let's find out about how they taste.
Okay.
Okay. Good morning, Sam. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hey, thanks, you guys. I have a gardening question. I've bought seed for a cover crop.
Uh-huh.
But it's like 3 years old, because I don't know when to plant that cover crop.
What kind of seed is it?
Well, I think it's red clover, and it's a mix.
Okay. Probably crimson clover.
Probably.
Red clover is, not to be technical, but red clover is a perennial that you'd find in, you know, it's kind of a weed.
Yeah, this is but like an annual.
Crimson clover, right, is an annual, and it's a mix.
Well, there's a funny Chinese saying, and not funny, but it's one that I heard yesterday, so I just kept on my mind. So they say the best time to plant a tree is now. No, excuse me, yeah. It was 20 years ago. Right. The second best time is now. So the best time to plant your cover crop was 3 years ago, but second best time is now.
Well, it's really too late to plant a cover crop.
Yeah, that's right.
With those things right now, it's right.
But in terms of the viability of the seed, I think the seed should be fine.
I think so too. And if it's a, just plant it much more or seed it more heavily than not. But the ideal time would be, maybe the second week of September through mid-October, this mix that you have.
And then you'd turn that over in the spring.
That's one method to do. I mean, a lot of books recommend that, this green manuring technique. Although I don't recommend that because it's just hard to get that. If you turn it into your soil, it's hard for the microorganisms to break it down when it's in such big chunks. And the ground is cooler in March, April, just because we don't have the equipment to chop it up real small.
Right.
Big tractors can do that, but not little wimpy tillers and things like that.
So you could also plant that cover crop in the spring, and then it will, you can turn it under or deal with it in June.
But generally you want to plant before June. I mean, your vegetables, you're trying to get those in April, May.
Right.
So that's why I say ideally. And probably a better suggestion on when or what to plant your cover crop in the spring would be to throw in a crop of buckwheat or something like that, or sorghum.
Sorghum, right.
Jim showed me his farm over the weekend, and that's what he had planted.
Those buckwheat and sorghum aren't frost hardy, so they need to be. Should be sown after hard frost is passed. So that's the only thing about those crops.
Right.
We use them as a summer cover crop at the nursery, typically into the fall.
Do they attract bees, Jim?
If they bloom, the sorghum doesn't so much, but
I know buckwheat does.
I haven't seen much bee action around sorghum, but we don't usually get it to the flowering point. It's by the time it gets to be flowering, it's like 6 feet tall, and it's a little hard to get it under control. So,
all right, Sam, that's probably more information than you wanted, huh?
No, that's great. So, on the subject of almonds, did you know they planted almonds in the Columbia River Gorge?
I did not know that. Whereabouts?
Up around Rock Creek, if you know where the longhouse is at Rock Creek.
You're talking like east of Hood River somewhere? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
What was Sam Hill's?
Mary Hill Museum area, Biggs Junction. There's an orchard down there on the Washington side, near there, near that turnoff to Mary Hill, and the bridge that goes across the river. I'm not totally surprised to hear that. They're probably not planting these Ukrainian varieties. I expect they probably use the California ones, which would be probably more adaptable, would be happy in that environment.
They planted them as it was part of the hype to get people to come out west and take up lands and homesteads. They planted almonds and walnuts to show how versatile the country was. And so there's producing almond orchards in that area.
I'll have to check that out. I actually go that way fairly often, so we'll check it out.
Yeah, go up the road up the Rock Creek Road, and they're up there on the bench.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the tip.
All right.
Adios.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Well, that's news to us.
Yeah, that's historical, sounds like.
Yes.
Not current. So I'm really, I am also quite curious why they haven't planted almonds, east of the mountains where the California varieties should do well as well. But, maybe they still bloom too early in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
But these Ukrainian ones are very interesting because of their late bloom and their success so far. And I think, you know, we here in the Northwest, we have a lot more soil moisture than they do in California. So my sense is we probably wouldn't be having to use so much water for irrigation here. In fact, we might not need to use any, which would be interesting as well. One of the things I've discovered recently, we traveled to Italy, I think I mentioned, and we saw a lot of dry land farming there with different kinds of fruit. And soil was not very good, and they didn't have the cover on it like we get here. I mean, here, if you have a bare piece of ground, boy, pretty quickly, there's all sorts of weeds and anything that just takes over and covers that. But I think keeping down the grass and having bare soil covered with mulch would probably be a really good way to reduce water needs for plants, because you don't have the grass competing with the plant for the water.
Yeah. Huh.
Anyway.
Okay, well, let's get to our little tribute to Alan Toussaint? Toussaint. Our linguist is slash engineer is taking care of us today. In fact, she's really taking care of us. That some of my tunes that I brought, she wasn't able to upload, but she found them. I don't know if she did. Did you find the Robin Ford version? Oh yeah, she's on it. She's our ace.
That's great.
Right. So these are all songs that were written by Alan Toussaint, but are performed by others. And this one is Robin Ford, called Fairchild.
I'm gonna go through your life with a fine-tooth comb to see what's going on. I ain't giving up without a fight, and I deserve a fair try. It's deep inside your heart, honey, I know you're a fair child. Could anyone else be loving you better than I? Could anyone else be loving you better than I? Main squeeze. It's mighty hard to convince myself it's all just gone in the breeze.
Well, it's kind of a shame to break into that, but the show must go on.
Glenn, you've missed your calling. The Glenn Andreessen Music Show needs to go on, too.
Well, pretty good. It's kind of interesting there that for about the last 40 years, I've played trombone. Wow. And there's the trombone in that.
Wow.
He actually has a solo towards the end of that thing. But
just a multi-talented guy.
Robin Ford there, yes. Well, this is The Dirtbag, Glenn Andreessen here with you, and Jim's with me. And we're going to talk about his supply of almonds that he grew.
Right.
Are they husked or shelled already?
No, they're still in the shell. That's the winter project, you know, as these rainy days continue, we'll sit around the fire and whack on them. But actually, they don't need to be whacked on because they're soft shell almonds. They're like, you just break them up with your fingers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. There's a kind of a couple of almonds that I've heard about, you know, I actually ran into occasionally, one called Hall's Hardy that some people might have planted and have. And it will bear nuts in our climate, but they're so hard that I'm not sure why they call them Hall's Hardy. They just call them Hall's Hard almonds.
Yeah.
It really takes a large hammer to successfully get the pretty small nut meat out of it. So, and the plant itself is not a... it's kind of a rangy plant. I don't know, at least in my experience, it hasn't, it's not something I'd want to have in my orchard. But the, these Ukrainian ones are like about the size of a peach. They're not a big nut tree like a chestnut or a walnut. Mm. And the nuts are soft shell almonds that you can generally, you know, break with your hand. You might need a nutcracker with some of them, but pretty easy to shell. And they taste good. They're great almonds.
You said that you have several buckets of them. How many trees did it take to do that? I mean, can we get a decent size crop off a tree?
Yeah. You know, that, I don't have actually data like I could tell you how many pounds we got, but I would say that a bucket, like what you might imagine, a regular water bucket, we harvested more than that off of each tree.
And when you say harvest, did you harvest or you just pick off the ground?
Pretty much picked them off the ground. Yeah. I mean, a few I took off the tree for just because they were sitting right there in front of me.
Yeah.
I just plucked them off. And I took some photos of them too, because they're quite attractive, actually. The little sort of orangey brown nut sitting in the inside this husk. And,
You know, it's about the same size as a
commercial
standard. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I think on the One Green World website, there's a photo of the, in fact, I'm sure there should be, of the nuts, of some of the nuts that we harvested.
Okay. Well, that's almonds in Oregon.
Yeah.
We've got other nuts that we can grow in Oregon and do. And we're just going to talk about kind of the big four. We think there might be some others peripheral. Actually, almonds is probably not a big four, but it's counted in that four. But the other big three, filberts, or if you're from out of Oregon, hazelnuts.
Yeah, you might think these days probably filberts are probably the big one.
Yes, you're right. But as far as growing in the city, I mean, just trees and street trees and home trees, chestnuts and walnuts are also there. There must have been a lot of walnuts planted back in the day, because there's a lot of walnut trees and I don't see as many new ones going in now.
Yeah, you know, sadly, Oregon had quite a walnut industry up until the early 70s, and then there was a really bad freeze. I think it was probably worse than 2 years ago in Eugene area, where they got down to minus 10, I think minus 12 it got down to. Mm-hmm. And the most popular variety was Franquette, and they were not hardy enough, and they got killed by that freeze. And California was just coming into growing walnuts, and so the California ones got, you know, took over the market, and Oregon just kind of
lost the foothold.
So yeah. Now, if you drive out toward McMinnville, actually past McMinnville on the way to the coast, there's still walnut orchards, one on the right side, as I recall, having been out there recently. And, you know, there's still a market. There's people growing, but it's just not the same as it used to be.
Yeah. Boy, a fresh walnut, it's tasty.
And I think Oregon ones always taste better anyway. Yeah. They're really a good flavor.
So it takes room, I suppose, for most of these nut trees.
Yeah, walnuts are big.
We don't really have any dwarfing stock, you know, as far as I know. And you said the almond can be relatively smaller tree size.
Yeah. An almond can definitely fit in an urban environment,
right,
you know, as a yard tree, as can filberts, you know, are also small nut trees,
mm-hmm,
relative to all to
yes,
walnuts and chestnuts.
Right. And they really are like, they're kind of a bush more than a tree, but they're trained to be a tree. I mean, they'll send out many stalks from the ground, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. And generally in orchards setting, you want to remove those.
Yes.
You want to just have a single trunk.
Right. You make it into tree-like.
Yeah.
And kind of like figs in some respects. You can get plenty of growth from the bottom.
Right. But the filberts, of course, are, I mean, there's so many of them around that people probably don't think much about growing them, but they're an excellent nut. And,
yeah.
And the new varieties are very productive, and the nuts are large and tasty.
And disease-resistant.
Disease-resistant, yeah. And very nice, and they're very attractive small trees as well.
What are there varieties that one would consider, should consider, or does just plant a walnut or plant a filbert?
Yeah, well, the filberts, they had a disease issue a few years ago. Eastern filbert blight was a severe, serious disease, and some of the varieties that had been planted were pretty susceptible to it. So people, one of them being Ennis, which was at the time, probably 15 years ago, was the up-and-coming variety, large nut and very popular, but it was very susceptible to eastern filbert blight. So the researchers at Oregon State made tremendous strides in breeding and have come up with some super varieties that are immune to it or don't get it. And so right now, one of the most popular ones is Jefferson as a main crop. Hmm. And then there's some other varieties they use for pollinators. A lot of them have these sort of Greek names like Theta, and those are used for the pollinators.
Gamma. So with these trees, we need... Do all of these trees need another variety planted nearby, or?
Yes, with filberts, absolutely. You need two types in order to get nuts. Almonds are generally self-fertile.
This variety.
Well, these varieties we've have so far appear to be self-fertile. I mean, you probably would get better crops if you had two, so there'd be more movement of pollen around. But in our research so far, they appear to be satisfactory as a single tree.
Well, I'm thinking here we're treading on some dangerous ground here. Maybe we better get to our stumper.
That's right.
We don't want to give too much away here, do we?
Spill the almonds.
That's right. Oh, that's a good one. So, yeah, let's do our stumper now then. Okay. So, Jim and I had a little discussion about this question. I wanted to make it harder, so I did. But we'll give hints if nobody can get close in on the answer on this one. So,
right. This is Glenn Andreasen, the suppressed potential college professor.
I hearken back to those days. Yes, which of the following does not belong in this list? Almonds, chestnut, filberts, walnuts. And why does one of these not belong in that list? Now, there may be plenty of reasons that one doesn't fit, and we'll accept them all if you can prove it. But there is one that we know of that is the one that we have in mind. So right. We'll go from there. So if you know the answer to that, or if you want to take a stab, 503-231-8187. That's also the number to call if you have any gardening questions, 503-231-8187. All right. Anything else we want to say about nuts, or should we go on and talk a little bit about persimmon?
Why don't we do persimmons and
then
come
back.
After the phone rings off the hook.
Right. Okay. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, the persimmons are now... the trees are looking a little more naked, and the fruit is there in the full Monty position. And it's a beautiful sight.
It is.
I mean, unless the birds get to them.
Right. Well, you know, I'm so pleased to see the excitement with people with these too, because it's been a very good year for persimmon, and more trees have been planted. Those trees are now bearing in a lot of cases, and people are like, it's great too. I just gave a talk last night in Eugene to the Hardy Plant Society folks, and there was just a buzz because people were asking a lot of questions about persimmons too, because we don't know much about them. I mean, if you lived in China or Vietnam or someplace, you'd know all the stuff about persimmons, but when do you pick them, for example? That was a question that came up.
Well, that's a question that I had too.
Yeah.
When do you pick them?
Well, as I think we talked about last time, there are two main types, the astringent and the non-astringent ones. And the non-astringent ones are the ones that are commercially available typically are flat fruit. So you can identify them from the astringent types, which, and again, ones that are around our area, typically more acorn-shaped, more elongated. And they all turn orange. And once they are fully orange, they are, in theory, ready to pick. Now, the longer you leave them on the tree, when the tree has leaves, they'll probably develop a little more sweetness, but you don't want to let them stay on the tree till they start getting soft, because then the birds will come and eat them. And the birds seem to know when that point is. They might come and take a sample peck, you know, and then let their neighbors, their friends know. But it's you want to get them off before that happens.
Well, they'll ripen more. I mean, they'll soften after they're picked.
Sure.
But will they mature, or will they continue to ripen like a peach?
I think an example for the astringent types is like the European pear. You pick it when it's firm, mm-hmm. and then it becomes soft, sitting on the kitchen counter or wherever you have it, and then becomes ready to eat. It's not really good to eat a new European pear when it's hard. You wait till it gets soft. So that model works for the astringent type persimmons, which include varieties like Seijo and Hachia and Nikita's Gift.
And they look different.
From the non-astringent types.
Right, right.
But they're usually longer. Now, Nikita's Gift is a more flattish one. So, but people probably know they have it because it's not been around for a long time. And then the other kind, the non-astringent type, whose names are going to end with something like with either Fuyu or Jiro, those are flat persimmons with usually some ribs on them. And those will also soften and become nice to eat, but you can also eat them like an apple. So once they're fully orange, and you got some out at the nursery when you're out the other day, you can slice those up and just eat them. And they're really
I had one this morning.
Great.
Delish.
Yeah.
I wish I had more.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of calls.
Okay.
So let's see what we've got. Joaquin, good morning. You got an answer for us?
No, I had to let you know there's another almond tree towards Hillsborough.
Another almond tree or orchard towards Hillsborough?
Yeah, orchard.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we're about...
What
did you
say?
Where would you find that orchard? Is it on one of the main roads or is that back road?
It's the old freeway, the old back freeway going towards Hillsborough.
Okay.
Highway 26, is that what?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And it's like a little small factory there. They make their almonds, covered chocolates, all kinds of varieties there.
Huh.
They go in there and get free samples, try their almonds. They use a different type of chocolate to cover their almonds.
So they grow their almonds right there too?
Yeah, they grow their almonds there, and they have a little factory. They produce all their almonds there.
So where are you driving on Highway 26? How would you see this? What would you see?
If you're driving on the old freeway towards Searsboro, to be on the right-hand side.
Oh, okay. Maybe we could look it up, do a Google search or something.
Yeah.
Come up with it.
I can't remember the name of it. It's been years ago that went down there.
All
right. Well, good. That's good industry.
Yeah. Thanks for the tip.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Francis. Good morning, Francis. You got a question or an answer? Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm going to take a guess.
All right.
Is it a walnut?
It's not the walnut, but why did you guess the walnut?
Just because of the way they grow.
Mm. Okay.
Inside, the meat is separated. But I have a question about gardening. We moved into an area which is obviously a domain for squirrels.
Yeah.
And it's their domain. We just kind of moved into it.
Yeah.
And they eat everything in the garden. So is there a way to keep squirrels out of the garden that you know of that's nice and not
no
evil?
No. What I do...
I guess we just get to share.
Well, you can net things. And that's just what I have to do. On certain things. I had a problem with the squirrels eating corn.
Yeah.
Just a couple of years ago.
And everything.
So what I did for the corn, this was after it didn't need any more pollination, so it was already done. You know, they were just maturing. I put bags over the ears of corn, plastic bags even. And boy, it worked.
Okay, we'll try that next year.
Yeah, just put them on the ones that you want to eat.
Okay, cool. Just regular old bags, like plastic bags or whatever.
Yeah, bread bags or something. You know, it's long enough that can handle it.
Yeah,
but
cool.
Yeah, squirrels are tough.
Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
I probably shouldn't mention have a heart traps and relocation of squirrels.
No, you shouldn't do that.
Okay.
As I told you, my friend in Eugene traps them.
Yeah.
I think he live traps them even just because it's easier to kind of deal with. And then he drowns them in a 5-gallon bucket. Mm. But these are the non-native squirrels. I mean, they've just taken in and are forcing out
the native squirrels. That's the problem with non-native stuff.
Sure. Well, the Havihard trap does catch them live, and yeah. and you know, you can take them, move them to some park somewhere. Where
No. That's just making your problem their problem.
But the park, you know, the squirrels are happy. You know,
they're going to be fighting for the meager amount of food that's there because, you know, they do establish territories, and then they, you know, die of starvation or they get bullied by, you know, the stronger ones. Yeah, that's just...
It's a jungle out there, Glenn.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's just, you know, it's tough to do. I have a hard time killing them too, but so I don't. But so I just try to, you know, use netting a lot and trap exclude them from the place. All right, I think Tammy's working overtime on the phones there. Okay, Victoria, you have a question.
I do. I also have a guess. I think it's filbert because it doesn't have the fleshy outside of the nut. It has the hard shell.
Well, the answer is correct. Is it not, Jim?
You're going to give it up, huh?
I forget.
But that's not why.
It's a botanical term for the actual fleshy fruit that's on the outside of the nut that we harvest, which is on the inside.
Well, what's the difference between that and a walnut, though?
Walnuts have a fleshy outer part too, don't they?
Yeah.
And chestnuts, I just harvested a bunch of chestnuts from my neighbor's tree and roasted them.
Yeah.
And ate them. And then almonds also have the fleshy outside.
Right.
But
so they all have.
Are born differently.
They have fleshy outsides too. It's a thinner husk,
yeah,
but it's green.
It kind of holds them, it cups them or something.
Yeah, but that's so.
Is that the reason?
No.
No.
Okay. And at least not the one that we have, the one that's more obvious, but that's
but
the right answer.
Filbert is the one that doesn't belong.
That's correct.
Okay.
But for other reasons.
Okay.
That what we're thinking.
So now someone needs to come up with the,
yes.
the reason okay, why filberts don't belong on that list.
I do have a question as well. This has to do with persimmons. I have the khaki variety. I don't know if it's just fuyu or sweet fuyu, but I have about a half of a bushel of them. I'm thinking of standing out in front of the post office and hand them out to people, only because I don't know how to store any of these. I've made a bundt cake. I've made, I've been eating a persimmon a day as an apple for breakfast, but they only last about 10 days.
Sure. Go ahead, Jim.
So you could put them in the fridge. That'll retard that ripening process. You know, when they get soft.
Well, I keep them out in my cold porch.
Yeah, but even colder. You know, if you put them in your fridge, that'll cold them back.
Okay.
So that would be one thing to do. And then there's some recipes which I think you could probably find them online. Persimmon pudding. Which is kind of like a cake.
But they're always made with the astringent type.
Well, the type you have, once they get soft, the flesh is the same.
Oh, really? I thought fuyus always remained fairly solid, like apples.
No. I just ate a soft one this morning. They'll ripen up. They'll turn a almost red color when they're soft.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, see, this is new to me.
So they'll last even longer than... You thought, without refrigeration.
And you know what I've done in the past is I've actually taken those soft persimmons and it was like take off that little calyx end and stuff and kind of put them in plastic bags and freeze them.
Okay, great. That's what my housemate said. We're going to get some gallon bags and we're going to freeze them.
Yeah.
So you take the calyx off to freeze them.
Yeah, and you can pull the skin off too if you want. I usually leave it on, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, I'd leave the skin on. Yeah. I'm into fiber.
Yeah, good.
That's some serious fiber if you eat the skin on.
And then you can eat them, you know, as a sort of frozen dessert, or you can later make them into cakes or cookies, and they add wonderful sort of moisture to the baked
goods.
Oh, good.
I don't have to do the pulping because I did a whole bunch of, I cooked them up and made some pulp, and then I froze that. So I don't have to do that. I could just wash them up and take the calyx out and put them in a bag and put them in the freezer.
Yep.
Excellent.
Yep.
Well, I still might stand in front of the post office and hand them out to people.
Well, our ace engineer, Tammy, said you could bring them to KBU, too.
Well, I live in Hillsborough, and I never go to Portland.
Okay. Our loss.
Thank you very much. And I live on a filbert farm.
Good. Good. Well, we're gonna hopefully somebody will come up with that reason why those filberts don't belong
on that list.
So.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that information.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. Okay. Nope. Okay. So we're still looking for why Filberts does not belong on the list that also includes almonds, chestnuts, and walnuts. Something distinguishes that. Something about it. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the fruit itself, though.
No.
Okay.
Which would be a clue.
It is a clue.
Yeah.
Narrowing it down here. Yep. All right. Well, let's go to our next Alan Toussaint. Toussaint. Tribute here as he passed away in the last few days here. This is by Aaron Neville, but the song was written by Alan Toussaint. It's called Hercules. That's from an album called New Orleans Funk. Various artists there, but Neville, Aaron Neville is one of those. Even Alan Toussaint has, Toussaint. All of that. Terrible. He's got some songs there, tunes that he performs there too. But we're back talking about persimmon.
Yeah.
And where we can get persimmon, you know, since Victoria doesn't come to Portland. So there are some stores that carry persimmon.
Right. There are some local persimmons that are being sold, including ones from Northwoods Nursery, our farm, which we took to Food Front Cooperative Grocery Store on Northwest 26th and Thurman. And they're really great. Really tasty fruit. I'm just thrilled to bring them there. And also, they have a Hillsdale store too, which our fruit will be found at.
Food Front. Yeah. And you'll see them around the town too. And I don't know what the best way to approach a homeowner would be. You know, hey, could I? Are you going to use all of those there on your street? Or because I do see a lot going to waste.
Yeah.
It's just too bad. And maybe after listening to this show, they'll know what to do with them.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, our loss. Okay, well, let's talk about some... we had some questions. That's right. Let's see. Mike. Mike has a question about olives, or his olive tree. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, fellas. How are you this morning?
Good.
Great.
Good. So, got an olive tree in my backyard, and it's one of the dark olives, and the olives have started to turn light purple, dark purple, not turning black yet, but number of them have turned into the dark purple, and I was considering starting to harvest them, wondering, should I wait for all of them to turn dark, or should I start harvesting just the dark ones, leaving the green ones on to mature a little bit more? Any advice on harvesting these olives?
Oh, yeah. You've got plenty of advice here.
All right. So, that, Mike, that's a great, great question. And I'm so pleased to have a question about olives here in Oregon, in Portland. I mean, like, you know, you're not calling from San Jose or
something. Well, we don't know. Are you calling from Portland, Mike?
Just at the base of Mount Tabor.
Okay, that qualifies.
That's awesome. I'm glad you have a great crop. So last year, last couple of years, I've been doing some olive processing. And I would say at this moment, what you described your olives, pick them all. Because the what happens if you let them stay long on the tree, they'll start to get soft. And that's not desirable for processing. That's good for making olive oil. In fact, when people make olive oil, they usually they're quite soft, and but they're not. Then again, at that point, it's very difficult to make them into an olive that you're going to eat as a table olive. So firmness is important. And what you describe, I have no doubt that the fruit is ready. If you were wondering if it was ready, when you crack open the olive, the firm olive, you'll see sort of a milky juice, and that's a sign that it's ready to process. And then the processing part is interesting. And what we've done in the past is we use a water curing method. So you can find this online, University of California. If you did a search on olive processing or curing, I'm sure you'll come up with this publication. And it's pretty basic. And basically what you do is you take these firm olives and you take a wooden mallet. That's what we did anyway. And you sort of wrap them with a mallet, and you put them on like a cutting board or something and just beat on them a little bit, and it sort of just breaks the skin. And then you put those olives in a jar, fill the jar with fresh water, and change the water every day for 25 to 30 days. And that actually leaches out the bitterness from the olive. And then that's talked about in this brochure. And then you make up a brine, a salt water brine, and add the salt water brine to those cured olives, the leached olives, and put them in your fridge. And within, I think they say 30 days, they're ready to eat, maybe even less than that. And I've been eating some that I cured a year ago, and they're just delicious.
How have you stored them, Jim, for that year?
Just in the fridge.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that make any sense to you, Mike?
Well, I got disconnected for a second, and I caught most of the answer on the radio. But my thought was to actually run them through my juicer to extract the oil and the other liquid, and then letting the oil and liquid separate and see if I could make my own olive oil.
Well, yeah. It sounds like you should leave them on then a little bit longer. On the tree,
okay.
Or on the bush.
If you're looking for oil, leave them till they get soft. And
okay.
And typically in olives, they use a press to get the oil out.
Mm-hmm.
Your method may work. I'm not familiar with it. But we were just in Italy where we were talking with people about olives, and they have communal presses they take the olives to, where for a community, they'll bring all their olives in and get them pressed. And you can make olive oil from green olives, too. And it's a different flavor, and your method would probably work for that as well.
And I should.
Yeah, I was going to say it's exciting. I think that making the own olive oil would be really fun. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. And I should clarify, when Jim says we were in Italy, that was with his other sweetie.
Oh.
Not me. No.
Yeah. I would certainly suggest if you've got that nice crop of olives that you should try making at least a jar of cured ones, because they're quite good. And that, to me, olive oil is sort of, it's not to me as valuable a product, because I like eating the olives, the fresh olives.
How many olives would you say you have, Mike?
Oh, well, this is my first year of having a noticeable crop. So I'm hoping in the future I am able to harvest more. This year I would say perhaps 2 quarts.
Oh, that's quite an accomplishment, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what made me think of the oil is I pulled one off, squished it between my fingers, and the aroma that came off of it smelled exactly
like opening up a fresh bottle of olive oil. I was really astounded about the aroma coming off and how it just smelled exactly like olive oil. So that's what inspired me to consider that route.
Well, my advice, just because I like the fresh olives, take one of those quarts and do the olive oil experiment, because you don't know how it's going to turn out.
Yes, good point. Yes.
And then take the other quart and try the curing method that I described, because I think you'll really like the fruit as fresh olives too.
Oh, I agree. I think that seems like a reasonable way to find out which method works best, and then in the future, hopefully continue down the same path and trying both. Now, before I let you go, is there things I should be considering with this tree going into the winter time after I harvest? Will it need any food as we head into the cold time, or just wait until spring and give it a little bit of food and make sure it's getting enough water?
Well, and a question that I would have for Jim is, do you need to harvest those before X, you know, too much rain, cold, freezing?
But. Yeah, I mean, if we were to get into a cold spell, which is, I don't see anything in the forecast. I mean, like I'm talking about serious freeze down into the low 20s or something, you'd want to harvest before that. Okay. Otherwise, you could let them stay on there. But even whether you harvest them or not, they don't really need anything. They're a pretty tough plant, and I wouldn't worry about it. You just let them go through the winter, unless, again, like there was some massively cold air come in, if like, you know, the one winter in 20 or 30, you know, then you might want to try to cover the plant.
But what about birds and squirrels?
I haven't seen them be a problem.
Mike, you ever had any?
I haven't had any problems with losing any fruit to birds or squirrels.
That'd be terrible, getting up one morning and there no olives out there.
You know, the squirrels don't have the jars to put the olives in and to cure them, you know, and the olives don't taste good, so they don't think that they're
trying to that's a good, excellent.
I really think they'd be turned off by how bitter they are. So. Yeah. But anybody that's listening, it's a fantastic tree. It's really
that's
amazing.
Great.
It's really pretty. It's not getting really big. We're getting, you know, 6-7 feet tall, so it's really manageable. It was a really fun experiment.
Great. Well, thanks for the call.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Good luck. Let us know how that both of those come out.
I will call back.
All right. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Good morning, Diana. You have a question or an answer?
I have a question. I was delighted to hear that someone could grow olives in our vicinity. Mine is substantially more premium, I think. I have just found out that my son-in-law likes rhubarb. I made a rhubarb quince pie, and he said it was the best he'd ever had. So I said, well, let me make one for Thanksgiving, which is what I get to make for Thanksgiving. But I'm thinking, oh, did I overstep? Where am I going to get rhubarb at this time? I wondered if you might have any ideas about that.
Rhubarb plants are done. Now, it freezes very nicely, so that would...
Yeah. And that's what I had done. I mean, that's what I had when I made the previous one. So,
and you're out?
I'm out.
Well, I'll bet you could go to a market and get some, maybe? No?
I've never seen it, but, you know, it seems like something that somebody should do.
Food front, got it. I mean, it'd have to come in from, you know, elsewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, some local processor freezes it, but I've just not seen that available.
Yeah, I don't even know if there's any commercial rhubarb growers anymore.
Any other listeners out there that have seen frozen rhubarb for sale?
I don't know. If anybody knows, I would love to hear about it, because I'm thinking, oops. Well, it's a good idea.
I've got some frozen rhubarb. I'll trade you some for a pie.
Okay, well, if you've got enough for me to make a pie for you and a pie for me, I will be happy.
Well, you can contact me through the KBOO website. I mean, the Dirtbag.
Are you? Okay.
Yeah. I probably
Which
have enough.
Which person am I speaking to at this point?
Glenn,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I like rhubarb. I freeze a lot of it, both in chunks and as a sauce.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm going to have some for lunch today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I discovered a methodology that works with the frozen rhubarb that made a much more tasty and less soupy pie than ones that I've tried in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I would be happy to share that methodology in exchange for some rhubarb. So there's an email connection that I can get on the website.
Yeah, there's a way to contact me through at the Dirtbag.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your information.
You bet.
Exciting about the olives.
That's right. Yeah, we've got a lot of adventuresome growers out there this time.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, good luck.
Well, thank you for the show.
You bet. Okay, Paul.
Hey, I was wondering if the filbert was the only beatified nut with the patron saint of St. Philibert.
Well, I think it probably would be, wouldn't it?
Okay. That's all I got.
Okay.
So we only have a short amount of time left, Glenn. I think we need to add another clue.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So this question refers to pollination.
Yes. Something about the pollination of filberts is different than the other three.
Right.
Okay.
Now the phones are hearing them already.
Well, Tammy is on the phone, but it's not for us. Okay. Well, I do want to get in a little bit of this next tune, but we'll wait till she's off the phone. But we can talk a little bit about some blooming plants that are going on now. No, let's do our next Alan Toussaint tribute song, and then we'll come back and talk about some blooming plants and get the answer to that question too. Once again, this is Robin Ford, but Everything I Do Gonna Be Funky. Robin Ford, that's both of those tunes, the first one and the last one, we heard are from his CD, Bringing It Back Home. Robin Ford.
Yep, like I said, Glenn, I'd just soon come here and listen to music.
Well, that's a good part of the dirt bag anyway. Yeah. All right, well, let's just talk a little bit here in our few remaining minutes here about some plants that are blooming here. I was out, as I mentioned, I visited Jim's farm over the weekend, and early Sunday morning, we went out and looked at his big experimental orchard, and we came across, no, we knew we were heading for that, some Eleagnus. Mm-hmm. Eleagnus pungens, also known, its common name, silverberry, is kind of a catchphrase for that.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, Eleagnus pungens and Eleagnus abingii were in there, and one has the more variegated foliage with some yellow splashed on it, really attractive. And this is a very interesting plant, which I'd love to know more about its origin. It's related to Russian olive and autumn olive, but it's the unique part of it. Well, two things that are unique about it. One, it's evergreen, so it stays, of course, very attractive all winter, and it blooms in the fall.
And it was still blooming when we were there on November 8th or whenever that was, 7th.
Yeah, yeah. And the fragrance was like, what was it?
Carnation-ish. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it'd been blooming for a month or something like that before then, even?
Yeah, very, very. It's interesting. When the sun is out, it seems to do more. It's more fragrant than
sure.
when it's not.
Those molecules can jump around more.
Aromatic, you know. So anyway, pretty neat plant. And if we have a mild winter, then there's fruit, actually fairly tasty fruit that ripens in the spring, late spring.
Yeah.
A reddish fruit with sort of silvery specks on it.
So that's the Eleagnus pungens, Eleagnus ebingii.
Ebingii, and it's also known as silverberry.
Right, and these are not the invasive weedy types that you see in eastern Washington and eastern Oregon as a weed.
No, these are not.
That's right. Nope. Right. Well, the plant that I will mention is a cousin of Oregon grape, our state plant, and these are the Mahonias that have been crossed by some in Asia, China, and mostly China, I think. And they have some cultivar names called Arthur Menzies. Another is called Sunshine, maybe Chastity. And they all are now just beginning to bloom now, sending up huge. They're 8 to 10 inch spikes of yellow flowers. Right. And very attractive to insects, including honeybees. And they don't produce an edible fruit, but they do produce berries, Oregon grape berries. We need to tell the answer here.
Yes, we do. And you know why? Because it also blooms in the wintertime.
Yes.
The filbert is wind pollinated.
That's what distinguishes it from the others.
Right. And there we are.
Wind pollinated. Okay, well, we're out of time here. Jim, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
I think, hopefully, we'll try this, our third annual beekeeping edition next month. Don't know about that yet, but stay tuned to the website and we'll figure that out. We're out of time. Thanks for listening. That's our story so far.
It's 12 noon. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members at a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. Also by Deacom Street Doorway.